Well, no, we're not going to talk about James Bond, but we're going to get pretty darn close. Pretty darn close. Secret Wars. 100 years of British intelligence inside MI5 and MI6 with Gordon Thomas. And Gordon is next with me on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Gordon Thomas has more than 30 years' experience as a foreign correspondent. He has written a number of books, 40-plus. He has firmly established himself as a leading expert on the very often sinister but always compelling world of secret intelligence. And he currently writes on intelligence matters for several global papers and lectures on various topics, from intelligence connections to the death of Princess Diana to the CIA research into mind control. And here he is with us 2 hours tonight with our floating format on Coast to Coast. Gordon, welcome to the program. How are you?
Very well, thank you, and delighted to be here, George.
My pleasure, too. And tell me, before we get going, the volcano, how bad's the situation for you? I know Heathrow is still closed, right?
No, it's open this morning.
Oh, it is, finally.
It's open, for, at least for the moment it's open. They have announced it early this morning that it's open, and flights will start to fly in and out, of course. So we know that's okay for the moment. People in Albion are asked, why did they go through all this? Because it wasn't necessary, some people are now saying. There's a lot of trouble heading for the government on this. But this morning, a little intelligence story that the government are caught up in, it's emerged that the prime minister of yesterday, so to speak, 15 years ago, but the prime minister of today, George Brown, knew that Downing Street, which is his headquarters, the center of intelligence and politics in Britain, he had it bugged. He bugged the waiting room, he bugged where Kennedy came, he bugged where all world leaders came, he bugged the cabinet room, and he bugged his own study, which is bizarre because he was trying to get to the bottom. This is, by the way, that prime minister is Sir Harold Macmillan. He was trying to get to the bottom of what was going on within his own cabinet because it was filled with scandal. It was the days, of course, of the Profumo scandal. Where his war minister was having a sexual relationship with a prostitute and sharing her with the naval attaché of Russia, so on. And this has only emerged because finally MI5 had agreed that they would have the official story published now. The interesting point is the author's a good author. His name is, he's Professor Christopher of Cambridge University. He wrote the book. It took him 2 years. He was given access to, he said, all the papers available, or at least all he could see, because I luckily have similar access to get material, which is quite interesting. I know you don't see everything, so I wondered what made him so special, but still. Anyway, he finished the book, it's about 1,500 pages altogether, and suddenly Mr. Evans, the head of, Jonathan Evans, the head of MI5, stepped in and says, can't publish that, you can't publish anything about bugging, that we bugged for your former prime minister, you cannot publish that. It's a breach of national security, an embarrassment for the service. And he actually wrote that in the forward of the book. So now that was taken out the book, so now we know that, of course, Downing Street was bugged. And the question now in election month coming, in May is the election, is whether Gordon Brown knew about this, why did he keep it secret, and what lies behind it. And this is now a little explosion ticking away as we run up to election days. But there's other little matters to do with MI5 which are intriguing.
Is this going to be his undoing, do you think, Gordon?
Oh, his undoing is pretty well guaranteed from a lot of other reasons, but I think it'll help towards his undoing. It also might help towards the end of Mr. Evans, who is a 51-year-old, bit of a maverick in some ways, but he's now done something which I find personally, after all these years of writing about intelligence, pretty amazing. He's just announced he's going to dismiss 100 of his agents. Now, you may wonder, what have they done? My God. What they've done is this. They haven't got the right computer skills. They're middle-aged. And they failed their latest computer exams. And, of course, when they signed on in the post-war years, computer skills were not really prequisite to intelligence gathering. But now he's decided, Mr. Evans, and what is needed in the modern world of fighting Bin Laden is that he wants agents who are spies who are able to use social networking sites such as Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
Now, recently, in the last few days, we've had reports that Bin Laden has been using Facebook and Twitter. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it's an interesting little thought.
It is.
But the real problem is also is that many of his agents, he says, have to go because they cannot fast-track any of the 200 languages that MI5 is now expected to handle in what they call the deciphering threat level. You've got to have a good knowledge of those languages if you're going to stay with MI5, apparently. What is interesting to me, because Evans wrote his own thesis at Bristol University, which is not too far from where I'm sitting, on a typewriter, and is now, but of course is now regarded as the services in Thames House headquarters as one of the fastest keyboard operators, and he wants everybody to match himself. James Bond, where would you be now, I wonder, because I'm not sure he's a great typist. He's also, of course, the service's top expert on Osama bin Laden. And he also has a fluent grasp of Arabic. And now he's beginning to use the virtual world to craft a series of bin Laden. He's trying to track bin Laden through the carefully staged series of messages which bin Laden is now putting out on various sites.
Do you think bin Laden's alive, Gordon?
Well, yeah, I do, actually. I do believe that all the intelligence sources I've spoken to have said he's somewhere in the north of Pakistan. They say that. The problem is they haven't found him. This is a simple thing. You would have thought with all the technology available, I mean, I'm thinking about we have a GCHQ, that's a government communications headquarters, which is just up the road here at Cheltenham. You would have thought with their links with Menbith Hill in the north of England and, of course, the National Security Agency in America, you would have thought they would have tracked him by now. But no, there's no sign. And there are these whispers now, not so quiet either, that bin Laden has been replaced. He's either died or he's almost gone into retirement as a sort of head of Al Qaeda, and that it's in the hands of others, younger people coming up. Now, these are just rumors, and you can, you know, these are stories that turn up from time to time, and you say, oh, yeah, better look into that. And they lead you nowhere. But intelligence people I've spoken to say, yes, he is alive, and yes, he will do something soon again. That's our concern. And it is a worry. And here in Britain, the fear is that he will do something to target the 2012 Olympic Games in London, and that would be an absolute disaster if it happened, because we are now in this country at the highest level of security, bar one. We're at really, everybody's very keyed up, particularly with the election coming, and since January, we have been at this high state of security alert. And in England today, or in Britain actually, you're photographed on average between 300 and 400 times. Everyone is photographed by cameras. There are more cameras in London than there are in Beijing or Moscow.
Why does England seem to be so concerned about terrorism compared to the United States in terms of, you know, the feeling on the streets? I mean, I'm sure governments are always concerned, but in England, like you just said, cameras everywhere. What is it about that area that is more frightening,
well,
I guess?
Exactly. But it's not just London. It's the other cities. We have spending millions on cameras, on security systems, on checks. The average person in London can expect to be stopped by a policeman under new laws introduced earlier this year Every 93 seconds, reports the Daily Mail yesterday.
Gee, just to be stopped.
Stop and ask, what are you doing? Now, I do a lot of television interviews for various companies around the world. And they usually come to my office. They've told me, coming down here into the country, they've often been stopped when they've been shooting pickup shots around the streets of buildings and so on. Why you? I said, well, what do they ask you? They say, why are you shooting that building? I said, well, it's a series of shops. There's nothing wrong there. I said, why are you shooting it? Why are you filming it? And these are the laws that have been passed now. This is an issue which the National Union of Journalists and Institute of Journalists are raising with the government and getting nowhere. And it's rather scary because you can be pulled in for nothing. And you're told, all right, on your way. And no reason given. And we never know what's in those streets. I suspect a lot of it is rubbish. They just pick it up for whatever reason.
Well, which leads me to a couple of these questions here, Gordon, and we'll get into your incredible work here with Secret Wars. I'm sure you've heard of all the conspiracies, and I just want your take on this. Conspiracy number one, that 9/11 was an inside job. Now, my definition of that is a little different from others, because I'm convinced that this planet has a world government, a shadow government that's out to manipulate other governments. And, you know, I think it's beyond presidents and beyond prime ministers. Maybe they hired bin Laden and his group of cronies to go ahead and do this. But in your opinion, what do you think of 9/11, first of all?
Well, 9/11, for me, is a classic example of gross intelligence failure. They had these people in their frame for some time, and the excuse that MI5 now give is this: well, we like to wait and see where the trail will take us, and they waited and saw it took them right to blowing up parts of London. This is the worrying part. There's no doubt at all that the intelligence was bad, that the leadership was bad, that the recruiting was bad, and it who knows what went on behind the scenes. Dame Eliza Manningham Buller, who was the head of MI5 at the time, has a good track record. She has built up a reputation. She became the top woman in intelligence mm-hmm. in Britain, and yet she did not keep her eye on the ball or the crochet stick, whatever she was using. And we missed out. The most worrying thing is this, that these terrorists were homegrown. They weren't imported. These are Muslims who'd been born in Britain, raised in Britain, and then went off to train in Pakistan. They were allowed back in. There was no mystery about coming back in there. Say they had British passports, they just came straight through, went back to their hiding holes and waited. And when the signal came, go do it, they went and did it.
Yeah. Now, is it possible that the intelligence failure was one of intent, that they knew these things were happening, and they simply said, let's just let it happen because we have a bigger agenda?
There is that possibility that they're always saying, when things go wrong, you know, when you ask them what happened here, we have a bigger agenda. That's exactly what they say. And it is also, in the terms of 9/11, it is also very much a failure, a sloppiness of intelligence. I mean, their surveillance is poor. Their training for surveillance is poor. They put on the street agents who were not familiar with the language at all. They couldn't speak any of the languages of Pakistan or Afghanistan at all. And this is the problem, because linguistic skills are all important, and they just didn't have them. And I know from talking to some of them in the past that they said, well, the reason we got rid of because we just couldn't speak the languages. And they don't speak the languages still. That's the terrifying thing. On one hand, Evans, the head of MI5, gets rid of 100 agents now. And now he's launched this week a massive recruiting drive to find young university students who can be trained in any of the languages that are needed for dealing with terrorists from the Middle East. And they mostly come from the Middle East, that's the point. So there's languages there about 45 languages you need to have some smattering of. And we have, you know, in Britain today, we have 2.5 million Muslims. Most are okay, but there's quite a growing number who you must be worried about, and sure, we are worried about, and the security services say they are worried about, and that's why they're at a high state of alert. But is that enough just to be worried? I don't know. They are very defensive when you talk to them. All they have excuses, you know, you don't know the full picture. That's always the thing they say. The full picture, of course, must be kept secret for national security, they say. Well, there's certainly a point in that. There's no doubt national security.
Of course, yeah. Well, you need to be concerned about that. Okay. Well, now, here's the other thing. What about weapons of mass destruction? Iraq, Tony Blair, in he goes. George Bush, in he goes. They were never found. Bad intelligence, or were we duped?
Well, you see, the point is, this business with Blair is a serious business. There's no doubt about it. There were no weapons of mass destruction. The point, one of the things that's interesting, I have one key witness for this, and he is Dr. David Kelly. Dr. Kelly was sent by Blair and the British government and with the Americans, regime, to examine whether there were weapons of mass destruction. He made 32 visits before the war to Iraq. He went everywhere, and he concluded that while Saddam was obviously interested in getting those kind of weapons, he was nowhere near getting them. And he reported this, and he insisted, and he gave evidence before Parliament on this, Dr. Kelly did. And the result was he died very mysteriously.
He sure did. I don't think he committed suicide, Gordon.
No. Now, nor do I. And nor do I. Now, what's happening now this very week, again, it's happening now, is that six of Britain's top pathologists are bringing a case to the High Court in London, which is the equivalent of the Supreme Court, if you like, to demand a proper inquest into the death of Dr. David Kelly.
Excellent. I hope that happens.
And I've spoken to them, these pathologists, and they've told me they have strong evidence that he was murdered, and they intend to push this all the way. Now, these are not some, you know, country bumpkin doctors. These are really top
pathologists. Now, if he was murdered, and we believe he was, what was the motive behind killing him? Why did they want to silence him?
Silence him? Well, there's a number of reasons. First, he was writing a book. He asked me if I'd help him with a book, and I said, look, I'd love to help you, David, and I will as best I can, but I'm in the middle of finishing my own book on British intelligence.
Right.
And if you can wait a little while. He said, okay, I can call you from time to time. I said, absolutely, you can call me anytime. I'm so grateful for it. But before he'd written 44,000 pages, 44,000 words, it turns out, before he died. And those pages, like so much else about Dr. Kelly, have disappeared.
Oh, my.
And I've written that story, and it's forced MI5 to say, those pages come under, guess what, national security.
National security. Can't see
anything. But they may contain vital evidence which shows exactly what Blair said to him, because he told me some of the things he experienced. He's heading down the street. They were quite amazing. How he'd gone in there, he'd been told there are mass destructions. You will go back and find them. This is Mr. Blair telling him, he told me.
Gordon, we're going to take this quick commercial break, Gordon. We'll come right back with you. We'll finish up with Dr. Kelly, and of course, we'll talk about MI5 and 6. We're getting real insight tonight on intelligence with Gordon Thomas, author of Secret Wars. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with Gordon. I've got lots more to talk with him when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Gordon, I want to talk a little bit more about Dr. David Kelly, but what's the difference between MI5 and MI6? What does that mean?
Okay, MI5 is the equivalent of the FBI internal security for Britain. It defends the defense of the realm inside the country. MI6 is the international arm of intelligence for Britain. It has agents dotted around the world. It has altogether a staff of 3,200, and MI5 around about 2,500.
So MI6 would be like our CIA then?
It would be exactly like your CIA. It's also linked closely to the National Security Agency. It works with all foreign intelligence services which are deemed to be friendly or not so. And a very good example of their gathering of intelligence is that I can tell you that having had the business of Iraq where no weapons of mass destruction has been found, they have now established MI6 that Hezbollah has been equipped with state-of-the-art Iranian missiles. And this story is new, and I can probably break it with you here. The weapons, which have reached a number over 50, arrived in South Lebanon after the assassination of arms dealer Mahmoud al-Mabou in Dubai, as you remember, last January. It has now emerged, and I'm told this, that MI6 agents have established that a month after that assassination, an officer from the Iran's Revolutionary Guard, who is responsible for arms transactions for Tehran, met with a Hezbollah arms dealer at the same hotel where al-Mahmoud was killed. And later, 3 weeks, I'm told, later, an Iran Air Force military transporter arrived at an airfield outside Damascus and crated weapons were removed to South Lebanon. Now, the weapons are the Iranian version of Scud missiles. They have a longer range than previous Scuds and could hit any city in Israel.
And I bet they have more wallop, too, don't they, Gordon?
Much more wallop. And even strike at Israel's nuclear facility at Dimona. That's in an MI6 report, which I'll be made aware of. Now, this leads the Middle East situation to a new level of danger because, as you know, the relationship between Mr. Bibi Netanyahu and President Obama is not at its best at the moment.
No, it's not good. It's kind of strained.
It's very strained. Now, what we're looking at here is a possibility that MI5 certainly believes that Israel will be forced to take action if the missiles are physically moved or even attempted to be used against Israel. That's a very dangerous thought. And yet we have Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, who I've interviewed once. Goodness, sir, that was the experience. And Hamas's Khalid Mashal, who, of course, has survived several assassination attempts by Israel, have met with President Ahmadinejad in Tehran. And in the words of one intelligence officer, they must be rubbing their hands in glee over the year-long rift between Israel's prime minister and Obama. There you are. That's the background to that story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very dangerous because there's talk, even as we were speaking now, there's talk in Israel that we are looking at a resumption of the war that left 1,000 Lebanese civilians and Israelis were killed in the 2006 conflict. It could be greater this time because if those missiles are fired, it'll spread. There's no question about it. It'll spread very far. And it's an area which is very, very disturbing. This is disturbing here in Britain. Of course, they're very concerned. And it's, of course, another reason why they believe that the sleeper agents, which are here, hidden away, MI5 states, will come out and do some terrible supported attack against us. And therefore, the relationship between MI5 and MI6, which used to be very separate, is now almost one. MI6 go out into the international field with MI5,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa, MI6 operate in Britain as well, doing their own roundup. So there are two services doing the job of, well, of one at the moment. But the terrorism threat is no doubt a very serious one. Very serious in this country.
Gordon, are you convinced that even if we had a world of peace, total peace, that there are still individuals, corporations that would want bloodshed and war, and that they would be the ones to initiate problems?
Well, it's not something I've looked at, to be honest with you, very closely, but there's no question it's a very feasible situation. You have a lot of organizations who survive totally on the basis of making weapons for war. We know that, and making sparing war. There's also, you know, you see what's happening in the financial market. It would be even worse than it is. You see what's happening in all sorts of markets which make weapons and chemicals and et cetera, which can be used in war. And this is very frightening because they're making profit, and our lads are dying in Afghanistan and places like that. And the hunt for bin Laden, as I come back to what I said at the top of the show, it's beyond me and beyond a lot of analysts why he has not been put to rest once and for all.
I know. And it's baffling to me, too.
It's baffling to everybody, and to people like you particularly, I can see that. And it's one that even intelligence officers say, what more can we do? Now, the thing is, it's not a question of money for MI5 and MI6. They have, like the CIA, unlimited budgets. It's called a secret vote in Parliament. There's no vote, of course. If they want, it's just a name for an endless supply of money. Whatever they want, they get. It's an incredible amount of money because we don't know it for a start, but we can guess it. It could be many billions a year is spent on security.
Yes.
And we don't know. And we don't. They don't have to justify it. They don't have to explain what they do with the money. They don't have to do anything except spend it as they think fit. And that responsibility belongs to two men, Jonathan Evans, the head of MI5, and the new head of MI6. He's been there a little while now, but he is the 15th to hold a post. His name is John Sowers. He's a knight of the realm. And at the top of the show you were playing, I was quite fascinated and amused, the James Bond
theme. James Bond theme.
Yeah. Well, so John Sowers would make a very good 007. He has extraordinary dance floor skills, even a Fred Astaire. He has a gourmet appetite for the good life. And he is quite extraordinary.
He's what we would call old-time British.
Old-time British indeed, but he's only 41.
Yeah.
And he came from his job as UN ambassador for Britain, and he's been there, and he is he's extraordinary. He insists that he puts stuff on Facebook, which is pretty amazing. Well, his wife does, actually, which is quite amazing. He insists he's known that he writes all his documents, his memos, with a prefix CX. The code only he can use. He insists on being called chief, which is the traditional title of the head of MI6. And he's a bit of a lad, all right, you may put it like that. He's quite different from his predecessor, Sir John Scarlett, who was very secret and didn't really mix that much. But you can actually get to talk to Sowers.
Well, he sounds like he's got prime minister potential in his blood, huh?
Well, he could have. He could have that potential, but he doesn't want to. He enjoys this life. He doesn't want to take that ultimate responsibility. He likes being a spook, as he once said. I like being the head of a spooky agency.
Yeah.
And I suppose every man to his taste.
Now, let's get back to the Iranian thing for just a moment, because this is a puzzle that I think is going to unfold sooner than later. I mean, there's no question that, you know, we've been, they're slowly building their nuclear facility, and they're going to get the bomb eventually.
Yeah, the latest figure says they'll have a nuclear weapon within 3 years.
And so they're, you know, while they're doing that, they're being very aggressive, as you say, you know, helping Hezbollah and everything. Let's go back for just a little bit, if we can, Gordon. And that is 1948, when they created the State of Israel after World War II and the atrocities that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad seems to not understand, you know, where all these millions of Jews were killed and slaughtered by the Nazis.
Yeah.
They needed a homeland. So the world felt like they needed to do something for Israel.
Yep.
And so this parcel of land that was called Palestine, they decided to give that land and create the State of Israel. In so doing, they forced a lot of Palestinians out, right?
Yep.
And they should have done something for the Palestinians right at that point, and they didn't. And this hatred now that has festered for 60-some years, it seems like it's not going to end unless something very horrible happens, in my opinion.
It's a very well argued point. However, we have to go back even further than that. We have to go back to the mandate, which was formed by the League of Nations, where Britain was asked to administer the area called Palestine. For Britain, that was a gift, because it gave it control over the Suez Canal area, ships, it gave it control over the gateway to the east, and it enabled it to have its great influence in the region. It was influenced in Iraq, in Iran, and so on. Now, we have to look at this, and we have to look at one man in particular. And that is the Foreign Secretary of Britain at the time, Mr. Ernest Bevin. Now, Mr. Ernest Bevin had not that much political experience when he was given that position. He had served as a supply minister in the war, but he had one terrible failing. He had been brought up and continued to believe in anti-Semitism. He was the classic anti-Semite.
Yes.
Now, I know this because for the last 2 years, I've been writing a new book about this very subject you've raised. And it's quite amazing you should raise it, because I'm literally, the book's coming out later this year, and it deals with that very problem. And what it shows is that Britain has a case to answer. Firstly, it was the mandate, the forces sent to carry out the mandate were the army and the Palestinian police force. And there was tremendous battles between the Arabs in the 20s, 30s. The war put a temporary end to them, but they went on immediately after the war. And what we mustn't forget, that the Jewish Brigade and the Jews of what was Palestine still fought in their thousands in the British Army. And they were trained, and they came back. And that's when we saw the War of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
And Britain pulled out. They had enough. They couldn't take any more because there was tremendous pressure at home. But it left behind great sores, great resentment. And they're there to this day. Now, today, of course, the Arabs have made different friends. I'm talking here about the Hezbollah,
yes.
Hamas, and so on. And they're going to be a problem for the very country that we left behind, that's Israel or Palestine.
And I don't know, Gordon, what would be acceptable to these people anymore. Surely the State of Israel is not going to give up much more than what they originally had. You know, they might give up, some various parts of the land, but they continue with their housing, which is creating another problem.
Well, this is a problem, too, because they've now dug their heels, and this housing is a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, and you see, Bibi Netanyahu is a problem. Not everybody subscribes to his punch him on the nose attitude. I've interviewed Bibi several times. He's an extraordinarily aggressive man. He's not the sort of guy you'd want to sit down and have a game of chess with.
He was in power once, he was out, and now he's back in again.
Yeah. And in terms of intelligence, each time he was in power, he authorized more assassinations, state-sponsored assassinations, I have to say, by the Mossad, than any other prime minister who's taken office there. And now I have to explain, this is not a criticism of what they do as such, because they are determined to defend their country, that's Israel. But the Mossad is the only intelligence organization in the world that has a state-approved team of assassins. They're called the Kidon, which in Hebrew means bayonet. They consist of 48 trained assassins, of which six are women. We saw them operate in Dubai most recently.
Mm-hmm.
They have, but on the two times, that led to a tremendous problem for Bibi Netanyahu. And the first time that he had a problem was when he tried to kill, when he authorized the kill of Kashel, the head of Hamas, on the streets of Jordan, and they messed up there too. These are two of the rare times that Mossad have made.
Why can't they sit down and work this out? That's what I don't understand, Gordon. Why can't they just do what's fair for everybody and work this out?
It's got so bloody in every sense. When you go to Israel and you go to Torah, I mean, I've been to Gaza, I've been to Damascus, I know the area quite well. When you go there and you talk to these people, they both sides seem to have a case. And when you want them to sit down, they say, you ask the Israelis, well, why don't you sit down? They say, we want to. When you ask the Arabs, they say, we'll sit down if they agree to this. Mm-hmm. And you end up with an endless stalemate. But I can tell you one thing, which is not generally known, is this. Meir Dagan, the head of Mossad, has had recently secret meetings with the Syrian intelligence chief. And those meetings have been to see if there's any possible common ground that they can act as brokers between their political masters and try to do what you are sensibly suggesting. Sit down and let's talk this through. But you see, the problem is the situation now with arms coming in from Iran, with a threat of physical war again.
Exactly.
And it's going to say, and there are many militants on both sides. There are plenty that will say, let's go. And I mean, the mood in Israel I've heard only recently. Why should we wait for America to tell us what to do? Let's go do it ourselves.
Absolutely. And then you've got these companies that produce missiles.
Correct.
They want to see them. They want to see those things.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely right.
And you know what else is bizarre? It has nothing to do with what we're talking about. I can't believe that Ariel Sharon is still alive on a respirator.
That's a family request. It has raised... People are saying the family want to keep him there, which is extraordinary, but that's their personal decision. They don't want to let him go. They believe that he should be kept alive. And I've tried to fathom this out. It's paid for by the family at huge cost. He's never going to recover. And it's sad. More than anything.
And yet his body continues to function.
Yeah. Well, of course, he's been kept alive on the breathing machines.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, stay with us, Gordon. One more hour with you. We're going to take some phone calls. You're picking up insight today that you won't hear anyplace else. Gordon Thomas, our guest, Secret Wars. We'll take your phone calls. I'll be back.